meeting of House.
Yeah, we're gonna have them.
Finance Committee order is approximately 1:33 on Friday, February 16th, 2018. President or Representative Ortiz, Representative Wilson, and Representative Vice Chair Guerra, Representative Pruitt, Co-Chair Foster, Representative Tilton, and Representative Dren, and myself, Co-Chair Seaton. Remind everybody about their cell phones, and today we're going to hear from the Office of Management and Budget on the Governor's Budget Amendments, and then we'll also take up HB 176, Ground Emergency Medical Transport Payments by Representative Wool. So Director Pitney and Budget Analyst Steininger, would you please come to the table, put yourself on the record, and go ahead, ahead and begin your presentation. We'll have approximately 2:30 to get through this. Would you like to take questions as we go, or do you want to wait till the end?
Thank you, Chair Seaton. I believe we should take, or for the record, my name is Pat Pitney, Office of Management and Budget Director. I believe we should take questions as we go. The list is fairly short, and I will take your hour and try to cut it to 30 minutes. with that, I will turn it over to Neil Steininger.
Hello, for the record, Neil Steininger, Chief Budget Analyst, Office of Management and Budget.
And before you start, we've been joined by Representative Guttenberg. Yeah.
Right. So in front of you, you should have a rather large spreadsheet with the consolidation of the budget amendments made to both the supplemental budget, the governor's operating budget, and the capital budget as well. So we will start with the supplemental budget amendments, line two. This is a negative or a removal of a supplemental item for $7 million, and this reflects the reauthorization of the CHIP program, or the Children's Health Insurance Program, which is part of the Medicaid program within the Department of Health and Social Services. This was reauthorized subsequent to the submittal of the governor's budget in December. Line five is a reappropriation for a capital project for NUTOC, and I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, Matarvik Community Development. This is not to exceed $960,000, and this is to somewhat jumpstart community development in that region and relocate the NUTOC community. Line six is a reappropriation for enhanced rural public safety. It is estimated to be $899,711. These are both being reappropriated from the same project, $960,000 going to the NUTOC project and the remainder going to enhanced rural safety. This project is located within the Office of the Governor, and that is to allow coordination between several different departments within the state to address rural public safety issues from multiple angles.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So are these general fund? I know they're reappropriates, but are they other general fund?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, these are reappropriations of a general fund capital project.
Thank you very much.
Representative Pruitt.
I just want to make sure, what are we reappropriating them from?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt. Sorry, I should have mentioned that earlier. There's a reappropriation from the Susitna-Watana project.
Thank you.
Do you know if there's questions? Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. And so that is, those three are the three amendments to supplemental items, a total of negative $7 million in general funds to the supplemental request, which there's another summary sheet that you likely have where you can see the breakdown of the total of supplemental requests, and that brings a total supplemental request to $171 million in unrestricted general funds.
Representative Guerra.
I just got confused, but these are amendments to the 2019 budget, right? And that, but you meant to say supplemental right there.
So this first section here, through the chair, Representative Guerra, the first section, the first. Okay. Yes. So on line 10 starts the FY19 operating numbers section amendments. Line 10 is a technical correction to utilize the Information Services Fund rather than interagency receipts for the Office of Information Technology within the Department of Administration. Line 11 is the addition of one position to support data collection, analysis, and reporting within the Department of Education and Early Development. This position will allow the department to perform value-added analysis for districts and for the department. Line 12 adds $250,000 of general fund program receipt authority for the Mount Edgecombe Aquatic Center. This allows them to receive income from users of that facility.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On line 10, can you tell me how much money is in the Information Service Fund and how long that fund has been a fund?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, this is a fund that was set up around our prior information technology organization. So it's been there as long as I've been in my job, but I think it's been there for probably 15 years. And when we went through the IT consolidation process, it was really an oversight of having interagency receipt authority. The Information Services Fund is the same type of money, but from an accounting change, it has statutory rules that focuses it on the information technology needs. So it's really a technical accounting change that, because we inadvertently used interagency receipt, which everybody else uses, where information technology had this separate fund type that allows has some rules around specific to information technology that is helpful in the accounting. So it's literally an accounting change, and the dollars stay the same, and it's been there. And I believe the amount of money, there's a larger amount of money than the $9 million, but I'd have to come back and talk to you about it. But this is kind of the annual operating that is anticipated, that was anticipated in OIT outside of what inclusive of what some of ETS did, but some of the technical stuff that ETS does stayed in that information technology fund source. So it really is just cleaning it up and puts all the funds into that one fund code instead of having two.
Representative Wilson.
So if we could just find out how much is in that fund.
Absolutely.
That would be very helpful. Thank you.
And Ms. Steiner, can you pull your mic a little closer?
Moving to the next page on line 13, this is the establishment of a safety officer within the Office of Children's Services and Health and Social Services. This requires $111,000 in UGF and 47.6 in federal funds. What this position will do is coordinate worker safety initiatives for that division. The division has seen an increase in the number of threats of harm and violence to their workers, as well as OSHA complaints specifically related to the exposure of employees to threats of harm. So also kind of together with that, line 14 within frontline social workers is $129,000 UGF and $72,000 in federal funds, allowing them to contract out for security guards for their Kenai and Fairbanks offices. Currently, the division has security guards in several of their other offices, and Kenai and Fairbanks have received threats that they feel require them to bring on security guards as well. So these are both surrounding the safety of the OCS workers.
Yeah, I think I just want to make sure I understand the structure of it, because it looks like we got 42,000 federal, 129 in UGF. Is the federal money base? Let me switch it. Is the 129 required as matching to receive the 72 in federal?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, within OCS, they have cost allocation plans, and through Title IV-E, it's not a direct matching requirement that a lot of programs would have, where you have like a very specific percentage match rate. This is more the way that they collect federal revenue is more dependent on the types of children that they have in care, the types of activities performed by the caseworkers and the employees, and it's a fairly complicated equation that gets to it. You are required to spend that general fund in order to get the federal revenue, but it's not quite a specific like 50-50 match or something along those lines that you might see in another program.
So how many people are we potentially hiring here?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, one person in that safety officer position, and then the security guards in Kenai and Fairbanks would be contracted out through a security firm, which is what they do in their other offices that have security guards.
And then follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up, Representative Pruitt.
I think I kind of understood your initial question, but I just want to make sure that if we were to not put the general fund forward, would you lose that $72,000 in federal funds on this?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, they would not be able to collect the federal funds without the general funds.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So how much authority have we been getting for the federal funds? Because, again, you said earlier that it depends upon what type of child, you know, what services. There's a whole lot. There's a big calculation. It's not like just a 10% matching like we do for our DOT portions of this. So we may not necessarily – I don't think you can really say we're going to lose this federal funding, because there is a maximum level of federal funding that's allowable to each state that we may already be butting up against. Is that not true?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, there's a balance. 5 years ago, we didn't have as many families qualified under the FEET 4E. 5 years ago, 4 years ago, 3 years, as many families qualified under the 4E. The 4E has a much higher federal rate. And this, the request is balancing it to what's eligible to fund, and that balance between the two funding sources, the general fund and the federal funds. But over time, our federal funds are increasing because we have more eligibility in the 4E area versus those that are more generally general funded. And I don't believe we are at a point where we're maxing out, at least because it comes as a per child, per family construct. So I don't believe there's a max out situation, but there is a increasing portion of this operation that's being funded by federal over the past several years.
Follow up. But my point is that it's about who's in the program on how much federal funding we're going to get, not necessarily how many positions that we have hired.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that is absolutely true. And this is just the balance of funding that would allow us to cover the contract for these individuals, given the other commitments we have in that operation.
Thank you.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. I don't need the exact number now, Director Pitney. There are certain positions you can add, and based on the rules that apply within 4E and the other foster care programs, there are federal matches. So if they decided to hire 4 security guards, there probably would have been a related federal match as well. This isn't federal money that is being taken away from some other this is an eligible federal money that we're taking away from some other use. There's still room for additional federal funds as we add these positions, correct? The 2 security positions, and where we'd add 4 security positions, there probably would have been a bigger federal match, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, this is not a zero-sum game. You are correct. It is not choosing to fund this over this. The federal money's federal money and the state money would cover this. And these are not positions. This is a service contract, similar to the way the service contracts work in the other OCS offices. So, and it is not position dependent. So,
Director Pitney, is this a maintenance of effort amount that is necessary instead of being a direct federal match percentage?
Chair Seaton, no, it is not. This is just the balance of what funds would cover the contract cost.
Thank you.
Line 15 is $2,214,000 in unrestricted general funds, $2,214,000 in federal funds for health and social services, public assistance, field services. This is to add positions to address the increasing caseloads and the increasing backlog in pending applications in public assistance. The division had a average monthly caseload in 2013 of 569, and in 2017 that risen to 676. They calculate out what it would take to get them back down to that caseload that they had kind of before they had a backlog, when there wasn't the backlog issue they're experiencing now. And I believe that number, I don't have it right in front of me, but I believe it was about 57. However, due to other efficiencies that they found through different reviews of their processes within the division, they think they can get back down to that caseload number with just 41 additional positions. So they are continuing to make progress on efficiencies in the way that they handle their caseloads.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So is this the area where we transferred money from one agency to another? Is this the same department? We took out adult public assistance to fund other workers?
No, this is I'm asking if this is adult public assistant here money that we're putting money back into.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the adult public assistance program exists within the Division of Public Assistance, but this is for public assistance field services, which these are the people that determine eligibility for programs like SNAP or Medicaid, as well as the other, like adult public assistance or senior benefits, or kind of any of those public assistance programs within the department. So this is the actual staff doing that eligibility work.
Thank you.
There are close to a dozen public assistance programs that these workers are going to administer, from purely federally funded ones like food stamps or SNAP to Medicaid to public assistance to general relief. Right? I don't want to make you go through every single one of them, but this is the public assistance backlog that are federally funded or partially federally funded, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, that's correct. The list I gave was definitely not inclusive of the workload that they perform. And they do vary from state-funded to federally funded and kind of everything in between.
Representative Brewitt?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think if what I understood, your goal was to kind of have an influx of people so that you can get rid of the backlog, which would almost make me feel that 41 is more than you that you'll need in the long term. Is your intent that once you get back down to whatever number they feel comfortable with, that the additional numbers will no longer be needed, or do you expect to need 41 in perpetuity?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, there was a period of time where, as the backlog was building, Mental Health Trust funded several positions on a temporary basis to help address the backlog, and there was more progress than we currently have when those positions were there, but we anticipate that these will be needed in the short term time frame, 3 to 5 years, and if there's systems and if there are kind of simplification of some of the processes, then there would be a place for savings. But we don't anticipate this to be a short term, like a 1 or 2 year. We really see this issue and some of the systems, being able to use the systems and simplify the systems to be more of a 3 to 5 year issue. And then I think it would be a place to continue to look. And I also think it's a place to continue to say, are we doing everything we can to streamline how we're doing this process?
I'll follow up and then Representative.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess there's two questions that come out of that. First, I guess I would ask, how is this going to change in terms of the total number? What percentage of your new number will be these 41 people? And I guess subsequently, if I guess the other question I'd have is, do we currently have any openings? I mean, is this something that how easy, it's 41 people, it doesn't seem like that would be very easy to fill. Do we currently have openings in that particular department?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, we do have openings. Part of adding these 41, and I don't have the exact count on my head. We have it in the backup, but it's somewhere in the 6 to 7% increase. There is a higher vacancy rate than what we would like, but part of the vacancy rate is the number of hours and the expectations we have on the people that we need it to be a more attractive work and morale basis. So we need to fill the vacancies we have, and we need to add these new people to bring the workload down overall. And so we'll continue to be pressing on filling those positions. And I think the position vacancy is, did you see it in there? We can get the exact numbers on those, but we need to fill the ones we have and bring these on board so that we can get that workload at a doable job.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Pitney, this is great that you're adding 41. And getting back to the 2013 level or close to it, one of the problems with these positions is the never-ending turnover and the ability to have somebody with experience that can handle more cases than somebody that's entry level has always been a problem. And part of that is the overloaded caseload and the management. Is the department doing anything else besides bringing the caseload down to make sure that these people come in and they do more than just remain entry level positions, that they stay and last a long time, that they get experience, the ability to do these things at a higher level of efficiency is in place? I mean, I hate to think we're just constantly hiring entry level and the turnover's there, and that part of the problem is the efficiencies of being able to handle these things without the experience. So maybe you don't know that, but is the department working towards that? This is one step, but there needs to be others.
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, I don't have a specific on that particular department, but I know it's an area of importance for every supervisor and every department in the state is to address the the retention. I mean, everyone is aware of the trooper issue and the retention and recruitment issue on the troopers. These jobs are good jobs if they're balanced in appropriate way and not overloaded and have an expectation of, you know, overtime all the time. But I would have to get with that particular group to find out what they're doing. But it is an issue that many departments are working to find the right solution to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When we were going over this in the Health and Social Services Subcommittee, we asked the question of why it was added as an amendment and not in the regular budget, and they said that there were some considerations that were being discussed, and I was just wondering if you could help me to understand what those considerations were as to why it wasn't included in the original budget request.
Through the chair, Representative Tilton, I'm... You will find some of the commissioners find me not to be quite a pushover. And any additions into our budget are scrutinized at a level that sometimes a commissioner might say is pretty tedious and how dare you. And this was an area, especially with the number of positions that we were adding, that we wanted to know how. There's been several reviews of this department, and how have we addressed the recommendations in the reviews to bring the backlog down? How did the impact of the mental health trust funding that addressed the backlog come down? How is our system improvements working? And it took that amount of time to get to the kind of the root cause that we're not going to get past this backlog issue without bringing people on in this, what I'm thinking is a 3 to 5 year time period. So it was really the back and forth and requirements for the department to really prove out that this was something we have to solve with people.
Thank you. There'll be more discussion on this. Yeah, there'll be more discussion, I'm sure, on this later. But just to shed a little light, the department, I think they told us about this last year. They told us about it this year. They would have liked additional positions if the funding were there. We've had funding problems. But what they've tried without positions is to have range 12, range 13, range 14 people work a lot of overtime, and what that's led to is a 40% burnout rate within the first year, and so we're sending money down a sinkhole. And so now the department, their explanation is, it's not working with overtime. We actually need positions, or else we'll just keep burning people out and spending money for a training period and not a working period. So.
Go ahead and go on.
Moving to line 16. This is within the Department of Natural Resources project management and permitting component. There's $100,000 in unrestricted general funds for the Alaska Geospatial Council. The council was formed in, I believe it was July of 2015, as a way to bring together several different departments within the state as well as external stakeholders. Can look at geospatial resources within the state. It was funded by a capital project. They're anticipating that those capital funds will expire towards the end of fiscal year 19. This $100,000 will get them through fiscal year 19.
Well, I'll let...
I'll add one clarification that the last capital project was started in July. It was in 2015. The council was started in the early 2000 to bring the department mapping resources, mapping needs and priorities under one statewide umbrella. So we had coordination. It also includes federal agencies. This $100,000 gets it through the next year. We anticipate to continue the council in the fiscal year 20 and beyond that this truly is a base expectation of the state, and it is a and our mapping, the coverage of mapping in Alaska is the least of any state in the nation, and we have years and years to go, and everything we do is dependent on mapping, whether it's resources, whether it's public safety, whether it's addressing village relocations, it's mapping intensive. So this is not new as of 15. This is a ongoing program that has always been funded by capital projects that needs to be built into our day-to-day operations. This gets us to through 19, and then we'll have to put it in the 20 budget.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Guthrie.
Thank you. So we just had this discussion in the subcommittee today a little bit about this. So what is the $100,000 for? Is it for the operations? Is it for salaries? Is it for purchasing data for maps? What is it actually for? For just the coordinating effort?
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, there's 3 to 4 main costs, and the there's one, a coordinator, a council coordinator. 2, there is a contract with a mapping provider that takes the public data collected but puts it into usable projects. There's the bringing the council together, and then there's probably commodities or whatever might be the fourth. There's probably another fourth one. Then this leverages money from the federal government for actual flyovers to do particular mapping of different sections in the state. And it's about $400,000 that they spend on an annual basis, split between the contract with the mapping group, personnel, and meetings.
Okay. Thank you.
Go ahead.
So the total of operating amendments is $2,652,000 in unrestricted general funds and $2,334,000 in federal funds and $250,000 in designated general funds. The next section and the 6 items contained are dormant funds that are being transferred back into the general fund. So most of these are fairly technical cleanups, but I'll go through them each. The mining loan fund has a balance of $200,000. A loan hasn't been made out of this fund since 1986, and there's been no appropriations out of it since 2004. The Alternative Energy Conservation Revolving Loan Fund also hasn't had any activity in it since 2004. There's $2,755,000. The Investment Loss Trust Fund has $2,298,000, and that fund was created during the savings and loans crisis in the 1980s and haven't been used since 2012. The investment earnings on bond proceeds of the Northern Tobacco Securitization Corporation, this is not so much a disused fund like the rest, but this is interest coming in, or investment earnings coming in from bond proceeds. There's $231,773. The Municipal Capital Project Matching Grant Fund and the Unincorporated Community Capital Project Match Fund, this is somewhat technical. There was this program ended, I believe, in 2004, and there was a balance left in these funds, and after 5 years of inactivity, the balance went back into the general fund. However, the statute that determined that after 5 years of inactivity didn't include interest going back into the general fund, so these amounts represent cleaning up that interest that was just left in the fund over time. The total of these is approximately $6.4 million that is going back into the general fund.
Are all of these sunsetting?
They're, the only one that's not sunsetting is the use of Northern Tobacco Securitization and the Investment Loss Trust Fund. Those don't sunset. Those are just funds over that are available to be deposited. The other ones are sunset programs.
Yeah, and thank you, Mr. Chair. And one comment. I just want to thank you guys for looking at the work that was done by our colleague Representative Tilton last year, who was working on some of these and identified some of these. And I appreciate that you guys have recognized that some of these things are sunset and there's funds available for other things. So, anyways.
On the next page, line 28, is $4 million in federal funds for a capital project for the Department of Environmental Conservation. This is for the particulate matter PM2.5 non-attainment area in the Fairbanks North Star Borough. This is for a voluntary heating device change-out program. Line 29 is $10 million, 4.8 in ADA dividends and 5.2 in general funds. This is for seismic data collection for the Department of Natural Resources. Recent federal action has opened up the 1002 area. Doing seismic data collection will help facilitate faster development of this region, and as a beneficiary of development in that region, it's it benefits the state to facilitate that faster development. Lines 30 and onward is an amendment to the National Petroleum Reserve Alaska Impact Grant Program. Every year we put an estimate of that program in the capital budget, and then it is trued up during the amendment process, because when we put forward the governor's budget, we don't have a full picture of the amount of money that's going to come in, and we don't know the grants that are going to go out. Just timing in that process results in this amendment. This year it's a rather large increase to the amount of federal revenue coming in for that program in the amount of $10.2 million, for a total of $11.6 million in NPRA grants. So these grants are going to various communities impacted in that region of the state. The first here is for the...
Don't go into detail unless...
Does anybody want to go through this list, or?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On line 28, the $4 million, is that so the borough can go looking for the grant, or is there another grant for the change-out program of $4 million that is just awaiting for an appropriation to pass through the state?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that one is not in hand, but it is imminent. It is the award. We don't have the award letter, but we have the award note that it's coming.
Can I follow up?
Which is why it's in this one. We didn't want to put it in the December 15 one, because it was still uncertain. Now there's certainty that it's coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And do you know whether or not it has the same restrictions as the current $2 million grant that they have, where the only way you can utilize the change-out program is to have a non-certified stove, not just a cleaner stove?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson will have DEC get back on the specifics of it. That I don't know.
Perfect. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay. The rest of these pages are the detail on the various NPRA grants. The total amendment to the 2019 capital budget is $10 million in unrestricted general funds and $14.2 million in federal funds. And if there's any other questions, we'd be pleased to answer them.
Any questions? Any questions? Thank you. And if there are things you're going to get back to us, if you do them through house.finance.legislation@aklake.gov, and that way it will come to the committee secretary and they'll distribute to all members. Thank you very much, and we will take the interviews while we switch topics.
Perfect.
Finance is back on record at 2:14 p.m. And today we will have an introduction of HB 176, which is Ground Emergency Medical Transport Payments by Representative Wool. And at this time, I'd like to ask the sponsor and his aide, Mr. Rob Earle, to please come to the table and go ahead and present. And if you could put yourselves on the record, and since we have two male voices, if you could just identify yourselves before speaking. And with that, please proceed. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the Finance Committee. My name is Adam Wool, representative from District 5 in Fairbanks. With me is my staffer, Rob Earle. I will present HB 176, and thank you for the opportunity to do so. What this bill does is allows the reimbursement to local fire departments and emergency medical transport providers to get more fully reimbursed when they transport a Medicaid patient. Currently, right now, the maximum reimbursement is $400 for an ambulance ride. And these this service costs more than $400 to the departments. And this will allow our state Health and Social Services department to apply for reimbursement from the federal government. It's been done in many states so far, and I believe it's time that Alaska also is one of those states. Currently, our fire departments and EMS services are compensated only a fraction of the cost, and this will allow them to get 50% more of the funding that they're not getting, if that makes any sense. And I'll give you a quick example. So if a fire department moves a Medicaid patient, they get $400 reimbursement. But let's say the ride actually costs $1,000. So there's $600 missing. This will allow the departments to collect from the federal government via HESS the $300, half of the missing $600, not the full $600, but half of it. And what they will do will apply. They will submit $300 to the state, and then the state gets the full $600 from the feds and gives that back to the fire department. So it sounds a little complicated, but basically it allows the fire departments or emergency medical transport, whoever happens to do that, it allows them to get more reimbursement from the federal government. And we can go into the bill details if you'd like, or if you have any questions at this point. I can give you some quick overview numbers. Last year, there's 21,000 claims for ground transport. And again, these are, so that would be if they're fully reimbursed, that's averaging $800 unreimbursed through Medicaid per, anyhow, 21,000 total claims for ground transport. So if it's $1,000 out of each one of those, it's unreimbursed, that's $21 million. And we would get roughly half of that. So roughly about $10 million we would be getting from the federal government for last year's ambulance rides. In air transport, there's 281 claims, and that we'd be getting about, that's a total of $5 million that's unreimbursed. We would get half of that, $2.5 million. So between the air and the ground, we'd be getting about $11 million from the federal government for last year. So we can expect probably more next year, since ambulances are being used more and fire departments are losing more money on unreimbursed ambulance rides.
Thank you very much, Representative Wool. Just FYI for the committee, we do have online available for questions Health and Social Services Director Margaret Brody, and we've got a question from Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I kind of got lost in your math a while ago.
I think I did too.
we'll just use the same thing that you did. So the fire department has 600 that wasn't reimbursed on a Medicaid one. They sent it to the state, and then you said they would send it to the federal government. 300 would come back, but then they would get paid 600. I thought they only got paid half of the amount. Or are you finding another 300 somewhere?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson. So we're missing $600, okay? So the way the mechanism is going to work is the provider, the fire department, let's say, will send in $300 to the state. The state applies and gets $600 from the federal government, of which $600 goes back to the fire department. So they spend $300, they get $600 back, so they're netting $300.
Follow up? So the first amount that was being paid, was that being... Who was paying the other $400?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson. Medicaid. So they're Medicaid patients. Right. So of the $400, and typical Medicaid is 50% state, 50% federal.
Follow up? Okay, so I'm still trying to get to the math part. And I like the bill, so I just want to make sure that
this
is right.
Thank you.
So the $1,000 gets charged for the ambulance, and they get their first $400 from Medicaid, which would come from the state. But then you're saying once the other $600 gets sent, the state will pay an additional $300 as well as another $300 that comes from the federal government. Or does the whole $600 come through the federal government?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, it's my understanding that the whole $600 comes from the federal government. And we do have people that are more experienced with exchanging money with the federal government, and that would probably be Margaret Brody. And my staff, Rob Earle, has had long conversations with her.
Mr. Earle, if you could put yourself on the record.
For the record, Rob Earle, staff Representative Wool. So through the chair, Representative Wilson. To go back to the example of a $1,000 ambulance ride, the first $400 is through state Medicaid. That $400 is funded 50% federal, 50% state. But then there's a $600 unreimbursed cost. So the department would submit their the provider would submit their non-federal match of $300 to the department, and then the department gets $300 from the federal government, and then sends the entire $600 back to the provider. So the provider nets $300.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow-up.
And then so the only portion that, if the full amount is given, I know there's a whole lot of, I'm sure, math into it, of that $600, I'm assuming that's what we're talking about, is that where the possibility of the 20% administrative fee of the state could come into? And it may not, it's up to 20%, so they may not take all the 20%. But is the 20% then on the $600? Where do they get to collect the fee so that all the paperwork that's being done is held harmless?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson. The administrative fee can be the way the bill is written. The administrative fee is 20% of the entire, can be up to 20% of the entire cost for the transport. I don't know if that answered all your questions or not.
One last follow-up.
Follow-up?
No, that does. So it would be of the $1,000. It would be just of the $600. Are we capping this in any way to where, for the department, that they can go, you know, no larger than what their reimbursable is, so that maybe if it's only 10%, our fire departments don't lose out as much? I mean, I want to keep the department whole, but I want to also make sure that as much as it can go back to our departments also can. I don't just want them to take 20% just because they can.
Through the chair, President Wilson, Rob Earle again. The 20%, it can be Once the bill passes, there's the state plan amendment that the department will apply for with federal Medicaid. At that stage, the 20% in other states, at least, has been able to be added to the provider's cost, so they can then submit that and get the larger reimbursement. The math gets a little bit intense when you do that, so if you have more detailed questions on that, there's a representative online that could help out.
No, that's perfect. Thank you.
Okay, we've got a question from Representative Guttenberg, then Guerra, and then Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think your example lowballs the cost, but that's fine. It's a good example. So is there a maximum allowable amount for reimbursement? I mean, if you're going, I mean, it's expensive to roll an ambulance down the street, but if you're going down the highway 50, 60, 70 miles, which is pretty common in Alaska, is there a maximum available? And let me ask my follow-up question. This is just limited to ground, not air medevac. So is there a need for the other half of that equation?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, we are going to add air, ground, to ground, and also water. Initially, we weren't going to, but by looking at the numbers and how many air claims there were, we felt that it was a good idea. There was, I believe, one other state that has air, and Alaska has a lot of remote places. So to answer that part, air will be on this in an amended form next week. Also, I don't believe there's a max because air is expensive. Transporting someone from Tok to Fairbanks is expensive. Longer hauls are expensive. So, and again, from my knowledge, I don't think there's a max, and that's why we're adding as many services as we can.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I certainly support the concept of the bill. I just want to understand how it works a little bit better. And fiscal notes, I'm learning, are really difficult to read sometimes. And maybe this is for Ms. Brody if she's online. I don't know. But the way the bigger fiscal note seems to read is that of the $21 million annual cost to the state, $11 million have come directly from the feds, and then the other $10 million is some form of statutory designated receipts, but I'm not exactly sure what. And so I'm just trying to figure out what the state cost would be for this.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Guerra. The $21 million is not a cost. It's a net gain to the state. And $11 million of that gain is from the feds, and $10 million is from the providers. So the fire departments will pay in $10 million, but then they'll get $20 back. So that's how they get the 50% number. So if the total liability is $21 million, the provider pays in $10, and then they get $21 back. So they have to spend 50 cents to get a dollar, basically.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. We've got Representative Seaton, and then Grin, and then Pruitt.
Thank you. When this comes back to us, can you provide us with a bubble flow chart so that we can see? I mean, when we're talking about, you know, there's $400, but then they're going to submit $300 of that, and then there's a $200 administration fee.
Sure.
And I mean, it's hard to follow without some kind of a flow chart. So if you would do that,
yeah,
I'd appreciate it. I'm not saying the numbers don't work, but it's hard to just listen to the conversation and understand how that works.
Representative Seaton, we can put it in a more visual, graphical way. Yeah.
And with an example of that, whether it's $1,000 or $10,000 or whatever.
Sure.
So we can see how those numbers flow and
we can do that.
Okay, Representative Grin.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Similar, I think, to Representative Guttenberg's question regarding maximums. Obviously, an ambulance ride in Bethel is more costly than in Anchorage. Does the percentage change, or is there any, if there is higher cost in another region or city, is there?
Through the chair, Representative Grin, I don't believe that. I think the percentage is the percentage. And we also have on the line one of the contractors that helped devise this program and get states on board, including California. So he is very familiar with the program, too. So if he wants to testify, or I think he has some prepared statements that might be enlightening as well.
Okay, Representative Pruitt.
Thank you. I just like I think everyone else, I'm trying to make sure that I can wrap my head around this. So there might be a couple questions, but first one is there any general fund being expended?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, yes. And that's to hire somebody to administer it in HESS, Department of Health and Social Services. And that's a fiscal note on another fiscal note, $116,000 initially.
Follow up?
Okay. And I do see that one. It looks like it's an interagency receipt that would happen there. So for the $10,700,000 in 2020 that would come from, it's designated right now, or it comes from 1108 statutory designated receipts. That is coming from, and I'm just going to use I'll use Anchorage just because. Sure. I don't know if they would. I'm just going to try to make sure. So that would be the Anchorage Fire Department would be, so if they're in the example you used, they would be sending us $300 that we would then submit to the federal government, and then the full $600 would come back to them. So they're basically taking their $300 and they're making $300, not making, they're getting $300 from the federal government. That's the concept here, and I'm trying to, am I right on that? And then secondarily, how in the world did the feds let this happen? Because it just doesn't seem like, that sounds like there's sanity from them. They would want us to pay out the nose to help them out, wouldn't they?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair. The first example of the $300 going from the Anchorage Fire Department to the state of Alaska, and then I believe the state of Alaska sends it to the federal government, who then turns that $300 into $600, and then it goes back to the Anchorage Fire Department. That is my understanding. As far as why would the feds let this happen, and I believe the gentleman who's online, I think there was something in federal law that they noticed, and they're holding him to it, and so far the feds are paying it. So, and he can explain it a little better. He explained it to us, and I can't remember the full explanation, but there was not quite a loophole, but it's someone said, hey, this federal law says we have to, you guys have to reimburse us, and so far the feds have been doing it. And Alaska, you know, could net $10 million, but some states are getting $100 million. So I think we should take advantage.
Yeah, I want to follow up on that, Mr. Chair.
Follow up?
So I'm trying to kind of think of how other states operate this. Do they do this similar thing where the local community goes through the state, or is the program in other states? Does the state just go ahead and take it on? They say, hey, we're going to request an additional $300. How do other states typically? And you mentioned California. How many other states do you know do this? And what is their typical model? And how does this kind of fit within what they're offering?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, the states that are enacted similar statewide programs are California, Washington, Montana, Nevada, Texas, Florida. Programs are pending in Oregon, Nebraska, Kansas, and Illinois. And I think Mr. Scott
Clough
is on the line, so he could better answer your questions about other states.
We have a chance.
Absolutely. We do have two people who are invited public testimony, and one of them is Mr. Scott Clough. Mr. Clough, if you're there, can you put yourself on the record? And if you need the questions asked, we can do that. Otherwise, if you could go ahead and answer those.
Sure. Thank you. My name is Scott Clough. I am
principal owner of AP Triton Consulting. Prior to my consulting career, I was a fire chief in California. I actually created the country's first GEMT program for ambulances. Subsequently to that, I created the program in Washington, the program in Missouri. I have the pending program in Oregon, and I have pending programs in Kansas and Illinois and Nebraska. So first I'll apologize. I'm in an airport, so if there's background noise, I apologize. So a couple things that I'd like to address to kind of help clear this up just a little bit. So in no particular order, I think it's important to note that this program is nothing new. It's actually an entitlement program that is part of Title 19 of the Social Security Act from 1965. Every state in the country participates in this program in one form or another. I had an opportunity to meet with your Deputy Director of Medicaid last week, and after talking about the program, he was able to draw a clear parallel to existing programs in your state, one of them particularly a school program. So this concept that we're talking about is absolutely not new. It's been in effect in virtually every state since 1965. It's currently in your program now in Alaska, and you're utilizing this. So the next thing that I think is important on the question side is there is no limit to the program as far as the reimbursement. As an entitlement program, this is a cost-based program. So unlike other Medicaid programs that have what's called a UPL or an upper payment limit, this program, the upper payment limit is tied to cost. So using California as an example only because of their diversity, I have very large departments like the city of Los Angeles that because of the economy of scale, their cost per transport is around the $500 to $600 range. Conversely, I have very remote departments, and yes, California has some very remote areas, nothing like Alaska, but very remote areas. Conversely, I have some very small rural departments and volunteer departments that because of their location and their call volume, some of their costs are in excess of $4,000 to $5,000 a transport on this federal program. So there is no cap. The cap is your cost. So the cost that Juneau may have would not be the same as Anchorage, which would not be the same as Fairbanks, which would not be the same as North Pole. So the cap is your cost. The second thing that I think is important to keep in mind is that this is an opportunity for local government to share in CMS or the federal government's Medicaid program. So earlier I listened to testimony in the previous hearing where they talked about the federal match and the federal funds. This is very, very similar to your previous discussion. So the way it works, and we'll use that example of the $1,000. If an agency has a $1,000 cost of transport, they're currently going to receive Medicaid funds from the state of Alaska for $400. This leaves an uncompensated cost of $600. So really what's happening is instead of the state of Alaska participating in federal financial participation as a state, local government is also allowed to participate in federal financial participation at the same rate, or what's called an FMAP. I apologize. And so what they look at is that uncompensated cost of $600, the 50% or the non-federal share is what the fire departments are partnering with the feds. That's their $300. The feds will match that based on your state's FMAP of 50%, and they'll match that with an additional $300. So they were correct when they said you got to spend 50 cents to get a dollar, but the 50 cents is the non-federal share that the fire departments are already going to absorb. The next thing is cost to the state. So because the programs are voluntary and because It's the individual local government providers that are asking to participate. There cannot be an expenditure to the state of Alaska. So while the state of Alaska may have to hire an FTE for oversight on the program, the cost of that FTE has to be paid for by the parties that are participating in the program. So there is never a cost to the state, never exposure to the state's general fund. The question on the 20%, again, a very complicated component. I'll be happy to provide some illustrations to the fire chiefs to help describe that. But essentially the way the 20% works, the state, because it's a voluntary program and because it's a program that's requested by the providers, not a program that the state is implementing on their own, the state has the right to charge a fee for those services. That fee is arbitrary from the standpoint of what you charge. As an example, Indiana charges 27%. District of Columbia charges 21%. California charges 20%. So the fee is whatever the state prefers to initiate on that. So the fee, that 20% fee, is a cost associated with the ambulance transport. So if the cost of transport is $1,000, then the provider could theoretically be charged up to 20% of that $1,000. Now, the thing is, they cannot receive reimbursement more than 100% of their costs. And while this may complicate the issue, the revenue that is collected by the state in excess of their actual administrative fees is permissible under the federal guidelines, and the state can redistribute those funds into whatever programs they see fit. And let me give you an example. In California, we do a CPE, a Certified Public Expenditure Program. We also do an intergovernmental transfer program. In the intergovernmental transfer program, we participate with hospitals, public hospitals. That program is $400 million a year. The state charges 20% or $80 million for that program. The state is total administrative personnel, is one full-time employee and one half-time employee, and I believe it's at $216,000 a year. The remainder of that $80 million that comes into the state is redistributed into other Medicaid and health care plans. So the state doesn't have to charge 20%. They can charge whatever they want. I prefer to see a cap at 20% because I've never seen administrative costs go that high. More importantly, it does provide protection that, let's say, hypothetically, only one provider participated next year. They would still be able to cover the state's cost, so there's no exposure to the GF. Is there any questions on what I've covered?
Any questions of the committee? Seeing no questions. Thank you very much, Mr. Clough. With that, we will go to our next invited testifier, Juneau Fire Chief Rich Etheridge, who's in the room here, and if you could put your name and your affiliation on the record, and thanks for being here. Proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Richard Etheridge. I'm the fire chief here in Juneau. I'm also a board member for the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association. I appreciate the time to show support for this program. As you may know, fire departments across the state are seeing unprecedented calls for service. We're also seeing decreasing revenues. Departments are really struggling to make ends meet. We're doing more with less on a regular basis. Here in June, our call volume went up 16% last year. The year before that, it went up 14%. And this year, we're already up 10% over where we were last year. So we don't see the call volume plateauing at all. As they mentioned, when we send an ambulance bill out, if it's a Medicaid patient, we only receive $400 back from that. The remaining portion of that goes as bad debt that's uncollectible for us. So that counts against us in our revenues for our department. What this will do is it'll give us, you know, 50% of that back, helping our department to make up that bad debt portion that we have. For Juno, we've estimated it'll be about $500,000. That's enough money that we could put another ambulance on the road. Right now, we've got two ambulances on the road to serve a population of 30,000 people. We're having police officers and fire chiefs sitting with patients and waiting for an ambulance to be able to be free to provide services and get them to a hospital. Being able to add an additional ambulance would really help out, our community. With the uncertainty that municipalities are facing with what gets funded and what doesn't, our funding is, questioned every year on what dollars we get. This program would give us some stability that we know that as the call volume goes and the demand goes up, we've got some increased funds coming back into the department that we're not having to write off. This is a win-win for everybody. This is money that's already sitting out there, so it's not additional tax dollars that people are paying. It doesn't end up costing the state anything, and it brings back some of our unrecoverable costs. We haven't found any downsides. We've talked to chiefs from several states that are doing this, and this is really helping out with staffing issues, training issues, and equipment issues. In Juneau, we're looking at $500,000 coming back into our community. I know Anchorage is looking at about $4 million coming back into their community. In the smaller departments, if you get out into the very small communities, where, as they mentioned, a transport could cost, $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 to get somebody back to Anchorage for, definitive care. They may only do 20 transports in a year, but, the amount of money they'll be able to recoup from that will make a massive difference to their budgets. One of the villages near Juneau, their entire training budget is $1,200. So if you could put another $5,000-$10,000 back into their budget, it's a small amount on the state level, but to that community, that's more than their department budget at the time. So fire chiefs support this bill. We really like to see it go forward this year, and I'm open to any questions.
We got a question from Representative Seaton.
And of course, this is all based on Medicaid transport. So what is the percentage of Medicaid runs that you make compared to your total? I'm
sure.
Not asking for exact.
Okay. Here in Juneau, Medicaid runs run about 25% of our call volume. In some smaller communities that have a much larger Medicaid population, it could be 80, 90% of their call volume. Right now, we're running about 5,000 incidents a year, and 80% of those are medical calls. So 25% of that 5,000 is what we're facing.
Great. Thank you.
Sure.
Do you have any further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Etheridge.
Thank you for your time.
So we will now move to public testimony. Public testimony is open on HB 176. And we'll start here in the room. Ms. Kathy Wasserman, if you could put yourself on the record, your name and your affiliation, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Kathy Wasserman, Alaska Municipal League. Chief Etheridge, who also sits on the Alaska Municipal League Board, brought this to us approximately a year and a half ago, and I've been trying to follow it as closely as possible. AML also represents many affiliate organizations, and one of them we help with is the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association, so we help with their issues. I guess when I would sit back as members of this committee, I would think, this is a no-brainer. This keeps a little more of the heat off of you because it allows us to get much needed funds through other avenues, and every bit that we can help ourselves raise our revenues, it keeps us from your door more and more. This money is revenue neutral, so it will not cost the state except for that position, which, as was said before, can be recouped as well. So we would hope that this bill could go through. I have done as much work on it as I can see I feel my job is to look for things that may not work out, and I don't really see that with this bill. So we would encourage you to pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. We've got a question from Representative Garrett.
Thank you. Thank you, Kathy, for all your service over the years. I appreciate it. So I either missed an email from my community, which I have, I've been missing emails, so it could be me, or I didn't get an email from my community on this, and they seem to be they'll be the biggest recipient of funds from this. Do you have any idea, in every community's tax cap is different, so if Anchorage were to leverage $3 million from this, does this just count as, does this raise the revenue the municipality of Anchorage gets, or did it, or do you have any idea whether it just still gets capped by the same level of tax cap?
Representative Gareth, through the chair, I'm not sure of this, but I would assume every community is going to handle this differently, whether it goes into their general fund and then how it affects their tax cap, I couldn't say. Most communities that don't have that, and most communities don't, will be able to put it into their general fund and then pass it on to the fire department to cover those costs. So I wouldn't see that that would make a huge impact on that, but I could be wrong.
Through the chair.
Representative Kira.
I'm a co-sponsor. I'll support the bill, whether it helps my community or not. Thanks.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe it helps every community. I think where the difference would be the city of Anchorage, it would go into their general fund because Anchorage takes care of their police departments and their fire stations, which is different from the Fairbanks North Star Borough, where we have fire service areas. So unlike Anchorage, where the city would be putting in those requests, our separate fire departments would have to do it because they're kind of a separate contract than the borough. Maybe somebody who's testifying on the service areas versus the other might be able to make sure that we have that distinction right.
And Representative Wilson, through the chair, yes, you're correct, and that's why I said to Representative Guerra, each community is going to do it a bit different. Fairbanks is the only one of the few municipalities with many fire services, so they would be different again.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Ms. Wasserman.
Thank you, sir.
Online, we have Bill Howell. Bill, if you're there, calling in from Bethel, if you could state your name and your affiliation and proceed with your testimony.
Hello, Bill Howell here, Bethel Fire Chief. I am also a board member with the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, for hearing this bill today, and I am definitely a supporter and would ask you to do the same. We out here in Bethel are looking at this bill from the standpoint of the fact that our Medicaid transports cost the or lose the city nearly $400,000 a year in uncompensated revenue, and the recovery from that loss with the GMT program would basically match just about what we have as our discretionary budget in the fire department. So we're very supportive of that. And just as an example, so we've got a fairly conservative estimate with our ambulance cost of service at about $1,296 per run. We recover around $400 for each of a little over 400 Medicaid transports each year. So we're actually losing around $350,000 a year just on Medicaid. Just to echo some of the sentiments of Chief Etheridge, we've seen a 15% increase in call volume over 2016. We saw another 15 to 20% increase over the prior year. We provide a really important public service, and just looking for ways that we can help sustain it, but not just sustain it, improve it. To be able to purchase the equipment and provide the training we need to keep it going. Once again, thank you for your time today, and of course, very supportive of this bill, and look for its speedy passage to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Howell. Do we have any questions from the committee? Seeing no questions, thanks for calling in. Let's move over to Jim Stiers in Fairbanks. If you're there, if you could also put yourself on the record.
Hey, good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for taking the time to hear the House. Jim Stiers, I'm the fire chief here at City of Fairbanks. As far as calls go, our numbers pretty much mirror exactly what Chief Etheridge was talking about there in Juneau. Population's pretty much the same, so we're right on track of the same. One difference would be is that we're running about 32% of our calls are Medicaid calls, where I believe he was saying his was 24. So we'll have a little bit of different impact there. How this could affect the City of Fairbanks and the citizens here is, I mean, we all know what the state's financial situation is, and that's trickling down into the city's financial situation, too. Just this past year, when we passed the budget, we lost one firefighter position. Our current labor contract was non-funded. This gives us an opportunity to our revenue that I've calculated is going to be about $600,000 additional revenue into the City of Fairbanks. As you were talking, that would go into the general fund. It's up to the council how they appropriate that fund, that money back on different areas. But it does have the ability to not only fund the contract, bring the one firefighter back. We're also in really dire need of a full-time second-on ambulance. We're cross-manning a second and third-on ambulance right now with the people that are manning the fire apparatus. We're still running out of ambulances calls during the daytime. We're currently using area departments to come in mutual aid to give us a hand on these type of calls. This has happened so often that these departments are finally saying, you know, we've had enough. They're starting to slow down the mutual aid that they're going to be given to the city. But that happening, it's the citizens that are sitting on the side of the road or their house, wherever they may be at, waiting for an ambulance to respond. We have no units available in the city. So this funding potentially has the ability to help us out with putting more ambulances on the road, just as Chief Etheridge was talking about. Be zero cost to the state, zero cost to the citizens, the city. So I'm in full support of this bill, and I hope that you guys will too. I'm open for any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Stiers. Does the committee have any questions? I am seeing no questions, so thank you for calling in. Mr. Alex Boyd, calling in from Anchorage, if you could state your name and your affiliation.
Hello, thank you for taking the time, as I echo the other two officers. I'm Alex Boyd, Assistant Chief with the Anchorage Fire Department and a board member with the AFCA. I'd like to echo my support and the support of the Anchorage Fire Department for this bill. In Anchorage, we're seeing approximately 38% of our overall response and transports result, and that's resulting in an unrecovered cost of just over $4 million currently. So the impact of the Anchorage Fire Department would be considerable. We're right now answering about 21,000 responses, or I'm sorry, transports within the city of Anchorage, and this would help alleviate a lot of that financial burden that we're carrying with that. And as Chief Howell and Chief Stiers have both mentioned, the costs are going up and the revenue is going down. So again, just generally from the Anchorage Fire Department, this is a significant impact on our budget as well as our community, and we will support this strongly. Open any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Boyd. We've got a question from Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, I do have a question for you. Actually, I want to reiterate the question that Representative Guerra had earlier, is that do you see any impact to, because we have a tax cap that not every community have, do you see any sort of impact to you guys based on that?
I am unfamiliar with how the collection of these funds from federal government would impact the tax cap. However, there is potential for it to relieve some of our tax encumbrances by relieving some of our potential bond propositions if this money were to slide back into the fire department budget directly. Some of our needs would be met from that aspect. However, I'm not familiar with exactly how it's going to affect the tax cap.
I guess one more kind of follow-up.
Follow-up?
Yeah, because this, I mean, I was looks like some of the other communities have. I hadn't heard from our community, from anyone. I'm not trying to fault you on this particular bill and the impact that it has to the community. So this is the first that I had heard. If you could ask someone there and send myself or Representative Guerra or anyone else here that's from Anchorage area, the Anchorage community, Representative Tilton, she's asking for it too. I want to make sure that there's not any kind of negative effects, because to me this sounds very good, but I want to make sure that we don't inadvertently cause some other challenge, because this is the first time I've heard from our community on this particular piece of legislation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pruitt. Do we have any further questions? Seeing no further questions, thank you, Mr. Boyd. Is there anybody else in the room who would like to testify? Seeing none, anybody else online who would like to testify? And I don't hear anybody. So with that, we will go ahead and close public testimony on HB 176. And sounds like an amendment will be forthcoming. And if the committee has any amendments, we would ask that those be turned in to Jane Pearson in my office by 12 noon on Tuesday of next week, February 20th. And sounds like some folks would like to hear back, maybe from some constituents. And I think we'll also be getting a flow chart. And Representative Seaton has a question.
Mr. Chairman, I was wondering, I think Margaret Brody might be online. I was wondering if from the Division on Medicaid, if she would be available for a question.
Ms. Brody, are you there?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. We're talking about Medicaid transports. We're talking about Medicaid is all, we're talking about 50% reimbursement. Is that, do you know if that program treats Medicaid, regular Medicaid patients and Medicaid expansion patients the same? Is that 50% FMAP apply to anything that's Medicaid, or is there a different ratio if it's Medicaid expansion population?
For the record, this is Margaret Brody with Healthcare Services, the Director of Healthcare Services. Representative Seaton, they are treated the same. We do receive a higher federal match for the Medicaid expansion population. We receive a 94% federal match at this point in time.
Follow up?
Yes, I realize that. What I'm trying to figure out on is on this transport reimbursement, is the match 50% like it is in non-Medicaid expansion states or whatever their FMAP is, and would it be the higher FMAP if you were transporting a Medicaid expansion client?
Representative Seaton, how this would end up working, I know what you're asking. We will not be just charging 50% regardless of the clients. We would take a look at the claims that we had received, and we would ask for the appropriate match, whether that's 6% for the Medicaid expansion people or 50% for the non-expansion. Or no match for IHS. So we look at who was actually transported and what the federal match that we could possibly get for that, and that would be what we would send to these entities, asking them to provide just the match portion.
Follow up.
And I'm trying to figure out whether the I didn't quite hear the whether it was 60% or 6% or what you were saying as far as the match portion that would go to the either air transport or ground transport, what you would be applying for expansion population folks.
Representative Seaton, we would be applying the exact same match requirements as the original claim paid out.
Okay, so
That there's not a specific like 61% or 63%. It's going to depend on what that universe of claims held.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. Maybe this would have been a better, well, I don't know who can answer it, but I'll ask it. When we pass this bill, assuming we will, how does it apply across the state? So in Fairbanks, you've got a city fire department and you've got service areas. In Anchorage, you've got a municipal fire service. Does everybody have to apply for these grants, or is it just whoever puts in for it?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, it would be anybody who provided the match for the unpaid share. All these entities are already enrolled in the Medicaid program and meet all the other requirements.
So if I may, Mr. Chairman. Uh-huh. So the concern was the tax cap or for various communities. If you simply didn't file for it, you wouldn't get it. There wouldn't be a requirement for every entity, if it had a detrimental effect for them, to also file for it.
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, that is correct.
Okay.
Any further questions for Ms. Brody? Representative Guerra?
Thank you. Ms. Brody, this is Representative Guerra. I just have a question in anticipation of maybe an amendment, maybe not, but so the only state cost really is the administrative position to administer this program, which will be reimbursed by fees the way it's been explained. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, there are no state funds. The match for that position would be provided through these fees.
And through the chair.
Representative Garrett.
And I guess I'm just getting up to speed on this bill. There was some testimony that maybe the fee should be capped at a lower amount, but if the fees, if this bill were left the way it is right now, the department wouldn't charge in fees more for its position than is needed for the position. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Karen, that is correct. We would only charge what our costs are, and currently that's 0.28% is how it calculated out.
All right, thanks.
Representative Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My understanding is the way the bill reads, it's up to 20%. So I think, are you saying, Ms. Brody, that's just what you do now, not necessarily what the bill does? Because it sounds like the bill will allow 20%. That doesn't mean that the agency has to take the full amount.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that is correct.
Thank you.
Okay, do we have any further questions? Seeing none. So again, amendments will be due by noon next Tuesday, February 20th. And if there is nothing further to come before the committee, our next meeting will be on Monday, February 19 at 1:30 p.m. And at that meeting, we'll take up HB 197, which is community seed libraries, HB 216, transfer from dividend fund and crimes, and HB 79, which is omnibus workers' compensation. And so with that, we will go ahead and adjourn out at 3:05 p.m. Thanks.